And it's now day 34 of the partial government shutdown, and many federal workers are bracing for a second missed paycheck tomorrow. One of them is Leslie Reese, a mother of three who works for the U.S. Marshals Service. She is a management and program analyst, but she is furloughed, not working, not getting paid. She joins us now from Mount Clemens, Michigan. Leslie, welcome.
Thank you.
So how are you? How's your stress level?
My stress level is at 90-95%. Mm. It was extremely high before all of this happened because of some life issues that happened this year. So, I mean, I was extremely stressed to begin with, and this pretty much has reached an all-time high.
And tomorrow it's likely to get worse because it's Friday, it's payday. You're going to miss another paycheck. So a full month without pay?
Yes, that's correct. And what some people might not realize is we have a lot of deputies that have stay-at-home wives. So they're the sole income. And for other folks to say, well, how come you didn't have a savings, or why don't you reach out to family? Well, a lot of us are paycheck to paycheck if we're a single parent. And a lot of us, we just don't have the capability to just go to mom or dad and ask for money.
Yeah. So can we talk about your finances then? Because
sure.
As you say, you didn't have that emergency savings fund like we're all supposed to have, right?
That's correct.
Are you able to make your rent payment coming up this month?
No, I've actually had to reach out to any community action nonprofit organizations. I hate reaching out to people, and this is actually quite an embarrassing situation that I actually had to, I posted a GoFundMe page because I have called anybody that will listen to me or posted what's going on. I've actually visited food pantries for the first time, and I'm completely humbled by this experience. But, you know, the Michigan Unemployment Agency, I've started that a month ago. And just for an example out there for folks, unemployment, you max out for Michigan at least, is $362 a week. So as a single divorced mother, my Michigan unemployment, my ex-husband's going to get half of that.
For child support, so, yeah. And what's your rent payment?
The rent payment's over $1,000 a month.
So you're stressed. You're stretched thin, too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm down to the wire where I was just able to get a little bit of, you know, gas in my vehicle, and I can't even pick up my prescriptions.
Are you worried about getting evicted?
That, if this continues to go on, absolutely.
Yeah. You have three kids, right?
Yes.
What are their names?
Rebecca is 17 years old, Sophia is 9, and Connor is 6.
How are they taking this, and what are you telling them?
Rebecca would be the one that knows the most about this because she's a senior this year. So she sees the news and she knows what's going on with the media. Sophia's in the fourth grade and Connor just started kindergarten.
But even they can tell that mom is stressed out.
There's been times where I have them on the weekend and they're like, can we go for ice cream or can we get pizza? And no, you can't do those type of things.
Now, I don't know if you saw this news today, but Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross made a statement. He said that he does not understand why federal employees who are furloughed or who've been working without pay during all of this would need to go to a food bank. You've gone to a food bank. You're going to one. What do you say to the people who are in charge of the government who are saying things like this, that you should have maybe saved more money or that you don't really need to go to a food bank?
I would say that, first of all, maybe they should experience something like this and go without a paycheck. We are civil servants. We are the community that voted these people into office and stood behind them. So one of their main objectives should be to have some type of empathy.
I guess the question is, I've been wondering this for the 800,000 people who this applies to. After all that service you've given the federal government, at what point do you say, I need a new job?
It's funny that you asked that. I've actually been looking. The jobs really aren't out there either, because what happens is when you make a certain amount of money, and then when you're at that level with the government, folks like, you know, CVS, even local restaurants, they all want resumes.
Are you saying you're overqualified for the jobs you're looking for?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. People, folks won't even look at you.
That's Leslie Reese, a management and program analyst for the U.S. Marshals Service in Michigan, facing yet another missed paycheck tomorrow. Clearly, this has been painful for you and your family. Thank you for speaking with us about it, and good luck to you.
I appreciate it greatly. Thank you so much.
Well, Airbus warned today that it may move some of its manufacturing out of the UK if Britain leaves the European Union without a deal. The aircraft maker joins a growing list of businesses that are already stockpiling goods or shifting overseas amid the uncertainty over Brexit. Earlier this week, Sony said it will move its European headquarters from the UK to the Netherlands to avoid disruptions related to Brexit. Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn spoke in the House of Commons yesterday.
The CBI, Mr. Speaker, says the projected impact of no deal on the UK economy would be devastating. Leaving with no deal would be a hammer blow to manufacturing industry in this country, costing jobs and damaging living standards.
The CBI is the Confederation of British Industry. That's the largest business lobby group in the UK. Joining us now is BBC business reporter Russell Padmore. Russell, welcome.
Good to be with you.
So how worried overall are businesses in the UK at this point about Brexit?
There is a situation that as the political uncertainty continues, so businesses don't really know what they should be doing in the future, how they can plan, and what should be in the strategy. And remember, this is not just about British companies, it's about many foreign companies, multinational corporations with their headquarters in London. Some of them already deciding they don't want to be outside the European Union, so they've decided to move their headquarters. Japanese corporations like Sony, Panasonic, not so long ago. And Jeremy, many banks are also looking at the possibility that they need to protect themselves by having a financial operation creating another headquarters somewhere in the European Union, whether it be Amsterdam, possibly Paris. A lot are moving to Dublin in the Republic of Ireland.
Well, we were in Paris in the fall, and the head of the French Banking Federation said to us that Paris could benefit from Brexit because the financial sector may shift, as you say, from London to perhaps Paris. How is the financial industry in particular doing there in London?
Well, you have to remember that London, beyond New York, would count itself as the second biggest centre for financial trading. So naturally, the City of London's financial district and the adjoining Canary Wharf area, where a lot of financial companies are also based, would like to know that the future is certain. We have this issue of so-called passporting. This is where any bank operating in any of the EU countries at the moment can take their trade across the different borders in the European Union, a financial passport, for want of a better phrase. But once Brexit kicks in, once the British are outside the European Union, a new deal needs to be put in place. And that's worried a lot of the companies in the financial sector. Hence, they've decided that maybe London is still important, but for the moment, we need to relocate. And there's been a great competition from some of the European cities. Remember, Frankfurt is the financial capital of Germany. The European Central Bank is based there. Paris has a major stock exchange. They want to get many companies moving to the district, which is called La Défense, which would be the business sector in Paris. And Dublin, too. Slowly but surely, a lot of British companies have looked at Ireland as the place to be, probably because Ireland is that one country in the EU which also shares the English language.
Russ, I want to ask you one more thing. As people are so uncertain about what is going to happen next with Brexit, are ordinary people in the UK just sitting on the sidelines waiting, not making any investments because they want to make sure that they know what's going to happen, at least in the next couple of months?
Ordinary people have got quite worried about predictions from the Bank of England, for example, about all the uncertainty chopping off quite a lot of the economic value of the UK. The economy is going to slow significantly after Brexit, according to the Bank of England. And if there's a situation that the UK crashes out, in other words, the British leave the European Union, the divorce happens with no deal on a future relationship in place, then all the predictions are that that is going to be a really horrific situation for the British. And with talk about what's very key here in the UK is the housing market. A lot of people make personal investments in their own home, or some just invest in property. Well, there's a talk about a property crash as well, and that's frightened a lot of people off. We've seen the value of properties, particularly in London and the southeast of England, which is the economic heartland of the UK. Property prices here have fallen significantly, all based on the worries about Brexit. It's all about uncertainty. The politicians can't agree, so the people really, as you say, are probably sitting on the sidelines, and that's creating this situation that the property market and other areas of business, because a lot of investments have been effectively, people, businesses have been pressing the pause button, not knowing what to do, and others have been protecting themselves, moving out of London already. And we hear talk about, for example, of companies hiring warehouses to stockpile equipment, to stockpile supplies. The automotive industry, particularly the big Japanese companies, Honda and Toyota here, and Nissan, have said they're probably going to put a pause on their production in late March, early April, until they can sort out from their own point of view what the situation is going to be about Brexit.
That is Russell Padmore, BBC business reporter, joining us from London. Russell, thank you.
Jeremy, always great being with you. Thanks.
And by the way, next step in Brexit could be next Tuesday, a possible vote on Theresa May's Plan B. We'll see what happens here and now.
President Trump announced late last night that he will wait to deliver his State of the Union speech until after the federal government reopens. It was a concession to Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, who said she wouldn't let Trump address a joint session of Congress until the shutdown is over. Since she was elected Speaker on January 3rd, Pelosi has emerged as a formidable foil to the president.
Please don't characterize the strength that I bring to this meeting as the leader of the House Democrats.
That was Pelosi in the Oval Office last month warning the president during a meeting about immigration. But how does Nancy Pelosi compare to past speakers? For a look back at this important job, we're joined now by historian Nathan Connolly, co-host of the podcast Backstory. Nathan, hello.
Hey, hey.
And Ed Ayers. Ed, it's good to be speaking with you again, too.
Hey, thanks.
My pleasure. So, Speaker of the House, big job. Number two in line for the presidency. And Nancy Pelosi, household name today, John Boehner, Paul Ryan. But who was the first truly famous Speaker of the House?
Well, Henry Clay, who would have been, in fact, a bigger name than those folks in his time. And justly so, because he basically invented the speakership that we know now. He said, well, here's the thing. I'm going to give you these committees, and legislation will go to those committees, and they may never come out. I'm going to give the authority to those committees to determine what we ever talk about, and I will actually choose who's on those committees. And so he basically controlled, as a kind of the traffic cop, all the legislation that came before Congress in those early years. So he's Speaker three different times during, you know, the 18 teens and 20s when all this is up for grabs, and he basically grabs a whole lot of the power.
So it is a powerful position, and you'd think that being number two in line to the presidency, that it would be a launching pad to that job, but only one speaker has ever done that.
Yeah, and people might guess for a while that they'd like to have this at a cocktail party. I'll go ahead and tell them the answer so they can know. It's James K. Polk, which maybe is not the first name to leap to mind. But Polk comes in as Andrew Jackson's hitman, in a way. He basically comes in and makes sure that the Democrats, which is a new party, gets everything that they want. He silenced the opposition. And the big issue that he's dealing with is slavery. And he is the one who basically develops what people would have heard of as the gag rule that we still talk about today. He basically invented this to stop Congress from receiving massive petitions that were coming in against slavery all across the North. And so he stacks a committee with eight people of his own party and one sympathetic person to the other, and these petitions go in and never come back out.
Hmm. Okay, so let's talk about some modern-day speakers. And to do that, we're going to have a little bit of a quiz. I don't mean to stress you out. I think you're going to do just fine.
We'll see.
Because we have some archival footage. So let's hear this first one.
In September of this year, I will have served as Speaker for 16 years. And I'll have to serve just a few months longer in order that I might have doubled the service of Henry Clay, who served as Speaker of the House longer than anyone up to my time. He served 8 1/3 years.
Okay, I'm going to give you a little hint. That was a 1960 interview with reporter Eddie Barker, and it was courtesy of the Briscoe Center for American History. Any takers on this one?
I'll see if I can take that one. I'm going to
we're elbowing each other here. We both know the answer to this one. Go ahead, Nathan.
I set it up for you.
Sam Rayburn.
Yep, that's it.
Sam Rayburn.
Tell me about him.
the great state of Texas. So Sam Rayburn is a very critical figure in shepherding the House through, you know, some extraordinary times in the 20th century. The Great Depression was just at the wane when he steps into the speakership in 1940, and America really was trying to figure out what its involvement would be in World War II. That was not yet decided in 1940. Now, what's critical about Rayburn is two things. One, he's coming into this period at a time when there's broad disenfranchisement of African Americans across the South. So what that means is he's running from a safe seat, but many of the committee chairs are also running from safe seats. That gives him the ability to be a very, you know, light touch speaker of the House. He doesn't have to do a whole lot, but can instead let the committee chairs really dictate the agenda inside the House. And that makes him very popular and less fraught with the kinds of fissures that would have potentially shortened his term. So the length of his time at speaker is directly related to what the political scene is in the United States, particularly around voter disenfranchisement, even in Texas specifically, where they're running an all-white primary until the mid-1940s. So the mid-1940s is also, I think, a time when, you know, Rayburn is stepping into his role as a bridge builder. He actually is responsible for securing the vote, a one-vote margin that allowed the country to run the draft and gave us the military that we needed to effectively win World War II. And he's serving constantly as an intermediary between more conservative corners of the Congress and the New Deal coalition that is still holding together through the 40s.
Okay, that's Sam Rayburn. His legacy is enshrined. There's an important building on Capitol Hill named after him. Let's see if we can guess this next one.
And oftentimes, as I watched him give the State of the Union message, and he would thrill the nation because he could handle the media better than any man that we have ever had in the history of this government. But he was merely talking words like an actor that had prepared a script.
All right, any takers?
Merely talking words. It's a great line, though, isn't it?
So I hear a certain accent there that sounds like it's from Massachusetts.
Oh, I think you're close. Yes, yeah, very close. Tip O'Neill, 1980s.
Tip O'Neill.
Yep, it
absolutely.
Is, exactly. Absolutely. And he had a special relationship with Ronald Reagan, of course, a Republican, but Tip O'Neill was a Democrat.
Yeah, I mean, so Tip O'Neill actually succeeded John F. Kennedy's old seat in Massachusetts in the early 50s. And in some ways, you could kind of think of him as the last great northern liberal in terms of people who had political power in Washington. We know Dukakis, for instance, didn't succeed in trying to attain the White House. So, you know, Tip O'Neill was there as a kind of opposite of the Sunbelt politician and Ronald Reagan. The two of them certainly shared, you know, any number of barbs and traded barbs in public. But in private, the two men were, by many accounts, friends. They actually brokered a number of deals after hours. I mean, in some cases, one could think about the whole moment in Washington as one that was slightly less overtly personal in the attack. Although, of course, Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan were not opposed to, you know, giving each other the business in public.
Hmm.
Now, one thing about Tip O'Neill as well is that he, in many ways, became a kind of celebrity in the speaker's position because there were ways in which television was itself, you know, crossing this divide between celebrities and the political class. Reagan, obviously, is the top of that. So, I mean, I actually remember as a kid growing up, you know, in the 80s watching TV and, you know, just having images in my mind of seeing Tip on television for any number of reasons. And so I think it's important to think about the speaker's position as a symbolic one. And to do that, you really do have to appreciate, you know, Tip O'Neill as one of the early faces on the new kind of political celebrity approach.
Okay, by the way, you're doing great here in this quiz. We got one left to go. This one,
right.
I'm going to just give you a hint right away. This is a conservative, a Republican.
Okay.
We're here because we are taking the first steps, and we're taking them in a contract with the American people.
A speech in 1994, that word contract was very important.
Well, if Nathan can track a Massachusetts accent and understand it, I can do the same thing with a Georgia accent. So I believe that would be Newt Gingrich.
Where does he rank?
Well, we're gonna remember him because he's one of the more recent ones, and he's still offering commentary right in the here and now. But I think, you know, there's also a way in which, you know, Gingrich's tenure was certainly even more polarizing than the Tip O'Neill Ronald Reagan era. And of course, he tries to go toe to toe with the president and effectively loses around trying to basically keep the government open or failing to do so. So, you know, Gingrich has, you know, I think a history that is never really solid in terms of the great speakers in history.
He rose to power in the mid-90s, as I said, in that Republican wave. It ended 40 years of Democratic power in Congress. Ed, your thoughts on Newt Gingrich?
Well, you know, I think in some ways, as Nathan's suggesting, he became the most famous after the speakership. He's been able to use that for decades now to become a kind of pundit. So he's not actually in power very long like Rayburn or Clay, but he's able to parlay that into a kind of a media presence that its own kind of power.
I think I'd be remiss not to, you know, we've been talking about history, but not to talk about modern history and just wrap this up with Nancy Pelosi, a historic figure in her own right. How do you think history will view Nancy Pelosi?
I think there are two ways to view her contributions so far. I mean, obviously, with the Obama moment in the early 2000s, you know, Pelosi was in a very important position to basically, you know, shake the new Democratic Party up. But there are ways in which I think she tried to hold a somewhat, you know, conservative line, or at least a middle of the road tack as Democrats were concerned. Now, with the new crop of Democrats in the House, there are, you know, there's a sense at least that Pelosi's job is to basically shepherd this new group and bring the Democratic Party slightly to the left. I mean, her flank is now, you know, much more animated, much more active. And in some cases, it's going to be a test of her legacy to see how she's able to institutionalize some of the folks who are now trying to pull the Trump administration's agenda to a more leftward lean.
You know, and that's very interesting in terms of content. In terms of process, in some way, she's a throwback to these very first speakers that I was talking about. She knows how to use politics. And whereas Gingrich was more of a public-facing sort of media presence, Nancy Pelosi knows how to use the power of the speakership, or she's trying to use it, you know, with President Trump's State of the Union address and so forth. So it's interesting that she's sort of a more bare-knuckles politician than some of the people that we've had in more recent times.
Inspired by Henry Clay. That's Ed Ayers and Nathan Connolly, historians and hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. It's always good to speak with you both.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks much.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
BuzzFeed is laying off a big chunk of its staff. According to a company memo from CEO Jonah Peretti, the layoffs will affect about 15% of the workforce, or more than 200 employees. BuzzFeed hit its revenue target last year, but the company is still losing money. And BuzzFeed isn't alone. Gannett and Verizon Media Group are also on a firing spree this week in what could be a larger contraction in online media. For more, let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
Good day, sir.
And let's start with BuzzFeed. What do we know about why BuzzFeed is laying off so many employees?
And presumably, Jeremy, BuzzFeed is trying to approach some sort of profitability that it can maintain. I mean, that's critical for a startup with several rounds of both venture capital and media company investors, folks who at some point want to see self-sustaining financials, at least before kicking in any more money. BuzzFeed, you'll have to recall, has raised north of $500 million in a decade.
And probably a lot of our listeners recall that BuzzFeed has been in the news in the last few days because they published that story alleging that President Trump directed his former attorney, Michael Cohen, to lie to Congress about plans to build a Trump Tower in Moscow. And then the special counsel, Robert Mueller, took the rare step of disputing BuzzFeed's account. Is there something larger going on at BuzzFeed? Is it struggling to define itself?
I mean, the company is still standing by that story, but this speaks to a central conundrum, Jeremy, of digital journalism. Suppose it was the breaking story of the decade. Imagine BuzzFeed, which, you know, also does listicles on cats and LaCroix water. You know, suppose it ended up taking down the Trump presidency. Would that necessarily have subscribers and advertisers and even acquirers flocking to BuzzFeed? I mean, that's a purgatory that it just has to endure. No matter how great our work is, the underlying business model still isn't there.
Mm-hmm. And what about what's going on at Gannett, which owns a lot of local newspapers, and they announced that journalists at the Indianapolis Star, the Knoxville News Sentinel, the Arizona Republic, and many more across the country are also losing their jobs this week. What's going on there?
I mean, look at Twitter today. You have laid off HuffPo and Gannett staffers announcing their availability. There was this euphoria a few years ago that the BuzzFeeds and Huffington Post and other digital natives of the world, they figured out a way to make money on journalism consumed on smartphones. But outside of the New York Times and the Washington Post and maybe two or three other incumbents, no one has really succeeded in profitably transitioning from print to digital. And Gannett is really feeling that in spades.
Well, and Gannett is also dealing with the possibility of a buyout from a hedge fund, right?
That's right. This Alden Global Capital owns Digital First Media. This is a hedge fund acquirer of newspapers that believes in cutting even muscle where necessary to maintain a level of profit margins as overall revenue shrinks. I think the MO is pretty much, guys, it is what it is. Don't go blowing money on digital pursuits. Cut now and be financially disciplined. But of course, newsrooms and journalists, their advocates hate this and think it's just corporate raiding, pure and simple.
Right. And the other option, of course, is something like what's going on at the Washington Post, where a billionaire or in other big newspapers where a billionaire steps in and says, I'm willing to lose money for a while to beef up this newsroom. Or the option that we're dealing with right here in public radio, which is that we rely on our listeners and others to pay for it. And they do at the moment, at least in a lot of places.
That's right. The New York Times, most notably, it's most convinced subscribers to pay up and pay a lot for online access, even as its print revenue shrinks. Mm-hmm. It's kind of publicly owned, but its real decision makers control a special class of stock. So ideally, you'd love a billionaire,
right?
But this story hasn't been concluded in full yet.
The Senate votes on two bills today that would put an end to the 34-day partial government shutdown. Neither is expected to pass. This stalemate in Washington over funding for a border wall has real-life significance along the border. And that's where I was earlier this week, in Nogales, Arizona, where a steel fence topped with razor wire already separates the United States and Mexico. Santa Cruz County Sheriff Tony Estrada has been in border law enforcement so long that the building where he works in Nogales is named after him. We met outside his office. From our vantage point, we could see into Mexico. The American flag was whipping in the wind overhead. I see right behind me, your name is on this building. You've probably been doing this for a while.
Yeah, 51 years, going on 52 years, 25 years with the Nogales Police Department and 26 years as a sheriff. I've been elected a total of 7 times. That's a record here. I'm the only Hispanic sheriff in the whole state of Arizona. I am probably one of the few Democrats, at least the only Democrat along the border. And obviously, I'm the oldest one, too.
So it sounds like you might be the right guy to ask this question of, is there a crisis at the border?
No, there isn't. There is not. I think the biggest crisis we have as a nation, besides other things, is probably the drug problem we have here. You know, illegal immigration pales compared to the drug problem we have here in the United States. We have 5% of the world's population and consume over 50% of the world's drugs. We have a real issue with drugs. Immigration can be settled. There could be reform, comprehensive immigration reform. You can actually tackle that. You can actually work on it. You can actually solve it. The problem with drugs is something that's really going to be a challenge for us.
Okay, let's talk about the drugs then. We can see, we're up on a hill, we can see over into Mexico. Is that where most of the drugs are coming from, and are they coming through this area?
Definitely a lot of them. This is obviously a major corridor, and the reason for it is because you have a major highway on the Mexican side in Sonora that connects with the major highways and interstates here in Nogales, and that leads you up to Tucson and Phoenix. So we have a major corridor, and in the corridor we have international trade. We have thousands of tractor trailers of produce that come over every day. We also have from the twin plants or the maquiladora industry, we have the raw materials that are sent into Mexico, assembled and brought back. Then you also have the Union Pacific, got boxcars, there's hundreds of them going and coming back. It's a very robust, active border.
It sounds like you're saying those drugs, and we've been talking a lot about this during this debate over a wall, they're coming through the ports of entry.
Definitely. A lot of the people that they arrest at the ports of entry here, they bring them over to our facility here overnight and then take them to a federal court up in Tucson. What I have noticed for a long time is that the majority of the hard drugs are coming through the ports of entry. Just to give an example, on December 22nd, there was a truck driver with a tractor trailer was caught with hundreds of pounds of narcotics, okay, at the DeConcini port of entry and also at the pedestrian lane on Morley Avenue. Continuously, the agents are seizing drugs, and it's hard drugs, marijuana also, but the majority of the hard drugs are coming through there. If you check with Border Patrol, you will find out that in the rural areas,
They're not seeing the hard drugs. They're seeing some marijuana. Even that has been reduced tremendously.
Have you noticed any change in the types of drugs that are coming over?
Definitely. I would say a few years back, we would really be scared when we saw ounces of methamphetamine. Now we're talking pounds, we're talking kilos, we're talking hundreds. Methamphetamine, a real danger.
Why?
Fentanyl. Well, the demand. I mean, people are probably saying, okay, marijuana is not quite good enough for me. I want a bigger, longer, stronger high. So they're going into just about everything. They're going into fentanyl, meth, cocaine, heroin, and marijuana, of course. And, of course, we've got legalized marijuana in a lot of places, and Arizona obviously is looking at that as well.
So would a wall do anything to stop that from coming over?
Not unless you put a wall at the ports of entry and you don't let anything come through. And, of course, everything dies on both sides of the border. So it's a ridiculous attempt to try to convince people that is going to stop drugs from coming into the United States. It is not going to stop unless you address the demand on this side and you address the supply, which is coming through Mexico. For a long time, I've told people the United States took their eye off of Mexico for too long. Friendly little nation, and all of a sudden, look what we have. We have a nation where most of the drugs and people are coming through their border and into the United States. So we took our eye off of Mexico. Now we've took our eye off Central America as well, and this is what we're facing right now.
Well, it sure seems like the eye of America is on Mexico and on Central America now. So clearly that has shifted quite a bit, and it has for years. I mean, I was in Arizona in 2010 living here as a journalist. We were covering immigration. We were covering Mexico extensively. What do you think has changed?
Well, obviously Mexico has changed, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse. Obviously, there's a lot of corruption, government corruption as well. The United States obviously has to get more involved. There has to be more diplomacy. There has to be more assistance. There has to keep in mind that Mexico is a friendly nation. In spite of all the problems it has, still a friendly nation.
President Trump is talking about $5.7 billion for this wall. Sounds like you're making the point that a wall is not what we should be focusing on. But if law enforcement, if the federal government did have $5.7 billion extra to spend on border security, what should they spend it on?
Definitely not on the wall. Obviously, you can see we have a border fence that extends miles and miles east and miles west of the ports of entry here. So we do have something here already. Where you don't have something is in the real remote areas, which is very dangerous and very, rural. What you need, obviously, and to start with, there's about 100 vacancies at the ports of entry of officers. If you're going to vet people and drugs coming across the border, you need more people at the ports of entry. That's what you need. You need maybe more boots on the ground, maybe more technology. We've got all the technology here. You've got floodlights, you've got sensors, you've got cameras, you've got boots on the ground, you've got air support. You have everything in this small county. And I think it's taking care of the problem. We're not having a crisis here. If you go downtown and you're by the border, you'll find out that everything is normal. I mean, it's not like the rhetoric that people are scrambling through the ports of entry with drugs and everything else. It's just not the reality. What is happening is happening in a very subtle way. People are coming across, overstaying their visa, false documents, false claims, a lot of reasons. Now they're sometimes they even dig themselves under the ground.
But there is a problem. That is happening. We've also had two children recently die in federal custody. We, just over in the Yuma sector a couple of days ago, we learned that a group of migrants tunneled under the fence, a record number of them giving themselves up for asylum. Many of them were children in families. That is a problem.
Well, it is a challenge. There's no question about it. And it is a problem, and it is a crisis for these people that are coming thousands and thousands of miles for a better life. They're the ones that are suffering as a result of what's happening in their countries. Now, America is like a magnet. It will draw these people because they're looking for something better for themselves and their families. And you can't blame them. You know, the reality of it is that people are going to keep coming as long as you have these issues in Central America, even in Mexico. That is not going to stop. The wall is not going to stop them. It's not going to be the answer.
What's your message to people across the country who hear the president and his call for this wall and his call for Democrats to come to the table to end this shutdown? What do you say to them from your position here on the border?
Well, I can tell you that I was born in Nogales, Sonora, Mexico, immigrated when I was a toddler. legally at that time. And I have been in law enforcement here for going on 52 years. So I've seen this community, this border, you know, the evolve. I've seen the dynamics on it. What I would tell people is you need to come down here and see for yourself that there is no crisis down here. Everything is normal right here. Yeah, we have those issues of people coming across illegally, and that will always be a challenge. But to consider it a crisis and think that a wall is going to take care of the problem, that's an illusion. That's a pipe dream. That's a fantasy.
You have a lot of federal workers in this area. Is the shutdown affecting life here along the border?
Oh, definitely. The commerce, you know, obviously people that normally would be spending money here are real tight with their money right now because they're not seeing a paycheck. And a family member, a close family of mine, worked with ICE, and he says, I'm good for about 2 months. He said, after that, I'm going to have to do something about it. So it is not fair to hold these people hostage. These are federal employees. They're actually employees of the president, and yet he is holding them hostage so that he can build this big, beautiful wall that is a fantasy of his, and it's never going to solve the problem. It's not the silver bullet that's going to take care of drugs and people coming across the border.
Sheriff Tony Estrada, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
800,000 federal workers are set to miss another paycheck this week. And one of the things that has come to light yet again because of the partial government shutdown, now in its 34th day, is just how hard it is for many Americans to get through a month without a paycheck. About 58% of Americans have less than $1,000 in savings, according to a survey by Bankrate. Joining us now is Jeannie Fisher, who's a certified financial planner with Argy Investment Services in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Jeannie, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me back.
And does that surprise you that 58% of Americans have less than $1,000 saved? That surprises me.
Actually, it really doesn't surprise me because so many people live paycheck to paycheck, they don't even have the opportunity to build up a savings account.
And when you say that they don't have the opportunity, is that simply because the salary just isn't enough to support putting money aside, or people just aren't putting enough money aside when they maybe should be?
I think the one thing that I've really recognized over the past 10 years is it's not so much about what you earn, it's about what you spend. And we as a society, regardless how much money you have coming in every month, tend to spend every single bit of it.
Mm-hmm. How much should people have in an emergency savings account?
Well, the general rules from the Certified Financial Planning Board of Standard is about 3 to 6 months of your expenses. Now, I always tell people if you're a dual-income household, maybe 3 months is enough. But if you have a high debt load, you only have one spouse earning an income, and you have maybe an unreliable career like a furloughed government worker, then you should actually be leaning more towards 6 or maybe even more months.
It's interesting that you say an unreliable career because, of course, many people believe that a government job is a reliable career and a reliable paycheck.
You would think that, but, you know, I was actually looking up some of the history of shutdowns, and there's substantially more than you would expect. I mean, this is becoming a common card, I would say, that our politicians are using in negotiations.
What kind of expenses should a rainy day savings account pay for? Is it just, you know, putting food on the table or getting medicine, or should they also pay for things like, you know, a car repair or something, maybe a one-time expense, or paying rent?
Really, you know, if you are not expecting a paycheck for a certain time period, you need to be able to cover all of your expenses. Now, that rainy day fund can be used for one-time hits like a car repair or a medical emergency. The key is that you build it back up so that, again, if you ever find yourself without a regular stream of income, you can continue to function.
Okay, now let's talk about the people who don't have the rainy day fund. What can they do? Does it make sense if you're a furloughed federal worker right now and you really need the money to pay your expenses, does it make sense to dip into a retirement account?
Potentially. I mean, I think that that's an option. I think there's definitely other steps you should take first before tapping into your retirement.
Like what?
Well, I think the whole nation is really empathetic with all of the furloughed government workers. So the first thing I would do is reach out to any creditors, any utility companies, and actually ask for extensions on the payments or, you know, maybe to waive some penalties. That's the first thing that I would do.
And what about using a credit card and just racking up a bill?
I think that's what most people will do because it's the easy option, but really that would be one of the last things that I do. Of course, you know, if you have friends and family that you can ask for help and get an interest-free loan, that will probably be the best place you could go. I actually recommend for anybody who has a home equity line open on their house, which is basically a revolving line of credit on the equity in your home, that would be one of the first places that I would go to actually borrow money if you don't have an emergency savings account.
And what's a reasonable amount of money to be putting into that emergency account each month?
Well, I think it's all going to depend on what your goal balance is. Find your magic number. Maybe it's $25,000, maybe it's $50,000, but that becomes priority number one. Hitting that goal amount is the first thing that you should be doing. And then once you hit that amount, then, you know, your priorities can change and you can start saving elsewhere. But that is a goal that you should be addressing aggressively.
Do you think that there's any way that in 5 years or 10 years from now, that when we talk about this, that the number will be different, that it won't be 58% of people have less than $1,000 saved?
Gosh, you know, that's a really great question. And I don't know that I know the answer or can project, but what I can say is that there is significant research showing that the millennial generation, the younger generations, are actually making more financially sound decisions than their predecessors. Things like more millennials have financial plans. More millennials are apt to work with a financial advisor. So I would say the demographic trends are positive. I don't know if they will stand the test of time. I think we all hope they will.
Well, I guess that makes sense that millennials would save like that because we, the millennial generation, started in the working world right around the time of the Great Recession.
Exactly. I mean, and I'm right there with you. I graduated from grad school in 2009. And I think millennials are also seeing the pressure that their parents, the boomers, have. And they're seeing them trying to retire. And we're learning from those around us, life lessons, I guess.
That is Jeannie Fisher, who's a certified financial planner with Argy Investment Services in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson. I'm off tomorrow, but I hope when I come back, Peter, that the shutdown will be over. We'll see.
Don't hold your breath. I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.